The Carleton College Convocation Program is a weekly lecture series that brings fresh insights and perspectives from experts in a variety of fields. The program has a rich history dating back several decades. The selected convocation speakers assist the liberal arts mission of centering thoughtful conversations within education and beyond.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Katie Meyerholtz, and I am a member of the class of 2027 planning to major in biology and philosophy. It is my distinct honor and privilege today to introduce a remarkable individual whose contributions have significantly shaped our understanding of bioethics. Professor Françoise Baylis is a distinguished scholar whose work has sparked crucial conversations about the ethical implications of scientific advancements such as gene editing and assisted reproductive technologies. As we stand at the forefront of a rapidly evolving technological landscape, Professor Baylis's insights into the ethical considerations surrounding biotechnology, reproductive technologies, and genetic engineering are more pertinent than ever. Her pioneering research delves deep into the complex ethical dilemmas posed by these technologies, prompting us to question not only what is scientifically possible, but also what is morally permissible. One of Professor Baylis's seminal works, titled Altered Inheritance, CRISPR and the Ethics of Human Genome Editing, stands as a testament to her intellectual rigor and unwavering commitment to ethical inquiry. In this groundbreaking book, she navigates the intricate terrain of gene editing technologies, urging us to confront the ethical challenges they pose and advocating for responsible and transparent governance frameworks. What sets Professor Baylis apart is her ability to bridge the gap between disciplines, seamlessly integrating insights from philosophy, ethics, and science. She embodies the spirit of interdisciplinary collaboration and the liberal arts, recognizing that meaningful progress often arises at the intersection of diverse perspectives. In conclusion, Professor Baylis's work serves as a beacon of intellectual integrity and ethical stewardship. Her contributions have not only enriched academic discourse, but have also guided policymakers and the public in navigating the complex ethical terrain of modern science. Please join me in welcoming Professor Baylis to Carleton College.
So I want to start by, first of all, thanking you for an amazing introduction. I do a lot of public speaking, and I have to say very often people just kind of go on the web and read the first two or three paragraphs that they find on the web verbatim, so I get to listen to the same thing over and over. So that was really wonderful. Thank you for taking the time to personalize that. I appreciate it. I also want to say that I'm really happy to see all of you here today. I really enjoy public speaking, and I really enjoy it when I have a really diverse audience in terms of background, experience, stage of life, partly because the issues that I'm talking about, I think, are really important across a spectrum of perspectives, and it's really important in that context then that we pay attention to diversity. I'm going to talk today about altered inheritance, and so the idea that we are on the cusp of having the ability of changing ourselves, not only individually, but as a species. What does that mean in terms of ethics? What does that mean in terms of responsibility, in terms of politics, in terms of history? What is it that we think we're doing when we take on the project of changing ourselves? I don't know if everything I'll talk to you about today that I will witness in my lifetime, but what I'm talking to you about today is not science fiction. When we talk about designer babies, many people will refer to Louise Brown. She is the first baby born from in vitro fertilization in the late 1970s. And one of the ideas I want to leave you with is she is not a designer baby. Many people will tell you that, and if you Google designer baby, her name will certainly come up. What she is the first person born through in vitro fertilization, which means that you're taking the genetic material, the sperm and the egg, outside of the body to make a human. But all you're doing there is bypassing the physicality of the body. You're not doing anything that would not have happened in nature but for a choice being made to put these two things together outside of the body. So it's a platform technology, absolutely crucial to the later term project of making designer babies. This is the doctor who actually created the first designer baby, and it was science that starts in New York and ends in Mexico, which is where the baby is born, to a Jordanian couple. And it's in the context of a technology that's called mitochondrial replacement. And then in colloquial terms, people talk about it as the three-parent baby. And that's a context where what you're doing, in terms of the genetic material, you're working with sperm from a male, but you're working with two eggs. Because if you think about the human egg, as you might think, for example, about a chicken egg, you've got the egg yolk and the egg white. And in the egg yolk part, that's where you have what we call the nuclear DNA, and in the egg white part is where you would have what's called the mitochondrial DNA. And there are some people, some women, that actually have genetic defects in the DNA that's in the mitochondria. And so as a means of treatment, at least that's how it's proposed, what we do is we'll just get rid of that defective egg white, we'll keep the yellow part, the yolk, which is the nuclear DNA, and we'll put it into somebody else's egg where we've taken the yellow out and thrown that away. So we've ended up with a baby that could not have been created in nature. So that's the first time you actually have human manipulation changing the genetic makeup, and the child that is born will have DNA from three people. This is the first of the true designer babies. The one I'm really going to focus on today, however, is the designer baby created by CRISPR technology. The one I just talked to you about, the mitochondrial replacement, we don't know because there is no such thing as a registry internationally, but we imagine that there's probably just over 200 such babies around the world. With the CRISPR technology that we know of, there are three, and they're in China. Two of them are twins, and then there's a third baby. All of them are girls. They're nearly 5 years old. We don't know very much more about them for a variety of reasons. This is Jiankyu He, the scientist that did that work, a scientist that trained here in the United States and was repatriated back to China, which is where he created these babies. I want to talk a lot about the work that he does, but I don't necessarily want to focus on him, though I will come back to him in a minute. The main thing for you to appreciate, and I don't need the science to get any more complicated than this, is that what you're looking at with CRISPR technology is taking the double-stranded DNA, which is our genetic makeup, and you're able to make a change by doing a cut. So you're cutting the DNA, and in some cases, you're just going to allow that DNA to repair itself. But what you've done is you've disrupted it, and as it repairs itself, things change. Alternatively, you might cut it and insert new genetic material, or you might cut it and remove genetic material. But in all cases, what you're hoping to do is to make a permanent genetic change. And the idea then is that this replicates throughout the body. And that's what makes the manipulation at the level of the embryo, the early egg and sperm when they meet, is that you're then going to be able to make that change go through all the cells, as opposed to, for example, just making a genetic change to something in your blood, in which it might affect all of your blood cells, but wouldn't necessarily affect every cell in your body. So, CRISPR babies, do we want them? Jiankyu He has created three such individuals. Nominally, it was to address the problem of HIV. Could he make them resistant to that particular illness? But imagine what else you might be able to do with this technology. And I want you to think about it not only in the context of possibly treating illnesses, preventing illnesses, but adding traits that might not otherwise be there. Remember I said you might remove genetic material, add genetic material, disrupt genetic material, but you have to have a goal and an objective. You're not just doing this for fun, like you think you're going to accomplish something. So my question is, do we want them? Do we want CRISPR babies? We've been talking about this for a long time, and I've just put up here for you some examples of what you'll see in the public media, and pretty much it's enthusiastic, right? There's a couple of horror stories or images that we're going to just make a lot of little Hitlers that are going to run around, and that tends to be the image that people use. But what I want you to actually think about when you look at this is to think about some of my opening remarks. Where do you see the diversity here in these images? There's not a lot of diversity. Very narrow understanding of what might be an enhancement or excellence. So that's one of the first things I'd like us to think about, right? If you thought this was a worthwhile project, who gets to decide what the ideal human should look like? And is it going to include you, me, anybody else? What's it going to look like? Almost all of them are white, almost all of them are male. There are, however, other people that object quite dramatically to this technology. This picture was taken in March of 2023 at the International Summit on Human Genome Editing in London. And they have been to, this group of individuals has been to a number of places objecting to this project of taking over human evolution. And one of their major concerns are eugenics. And what's the context in which you think you're going to take on this project? And just so that we understand, this isn't only happening in England or the United States or Anglophone-speaking countries. Around the world, there are people who are deeply concerned about this technology. Now, leaving aside activism for a moment, because I think it's actually really important, what's actually in policy, laws, guidelines, etc.? And if you look at this map, and this is an article that we published a couple of years ago now, so it probably could do with being updated, but we haven't actually published the update. This is with respect to doing the work of heritable human genome editing for the purpose of reproduction. And what you see in red, which is pretty uniform, is most countries, if they have any kind of legislation, guidelines, policies, they're prohibiting this activity. They're saying, no, not here. So the interesting thing to think about is the countries that are in either shade of gray. Because what do we know about science? You don't have to do science in any one country. You can go to another country to do science. And in fact, in some cases, people imagine you can get on a ship and go into international waters and do science, right? And so one of the interesting questions becomes, is this important that you seem to have a preponderance of opinion in one direction, or does it not matter? The thing I want you to do is, if you can, just kind of hold on to this image of a lot of red across the map and compare it to this map. This map is for the exact same technology, the exact same genetic manipulation, which is to take the human embryo, to cut the DNA, and to either disrupt, replace, or remove genetic material. But arguably here, the goal is not reproduction. That's what they're saying, is we will do that manipulation in the lab, but we are not going to transfer it to a woman or to eventually an artificial uterus. We're not trying to make new humans. We're just trying to do basic science in the lab so that we better understand human reproduction, we can better deal with things like miscarriages, et cetera, et cetera. It's the exact same technology. So if we think about a platform technology, it gets introduced for one particular goal and objective. 20, 30 years later, it can be used for many things. So countries, many countries, approve in some way, shape, or form of doing this work in the human embryo, provided you don't transfer it to a uterus to make a new human. In time, will that first map I showed you look more like this map? And we need to think about it. And what might make it look more like this map? So let me give you a little bit of background in terms of history, science, and policy. These are the two women who won the Nobel Prize for doing this work, Emmanuelle Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna. Jennifer Doudna is an American, Emmanuelle Charpentier, a European. She's moved around a lot, so I don't know if she prefers to be referred to as French or German or what have you. But they did amazing work. It's an article that was published in 2012, so not that long ago. And it's gone from an idea in a journal to having this massive impact in the world in a very short period of time, literally the birth of humans that have been genetically modified. So where does this story start in terms of the ethics and the manipulation of the human embryo? It actually starts with this researcher who in April 2025 published a paper in a journal called Protein and Cell, not a top journal in terms of Nature and Science. And the reason I mention that is because he submitted it to Nature and Science and it was rejected on ethics grounds. And so not wanting to be scooped, because you know you've got something, you're first in the world, publishes it in Protein and Cell. And very quickly, what's important for you to understand is he took human embryos that are considered non-viable. Non-viable means they are inherently defective, they are unable to make humans. He manipulates them in the lab, not overly successful in terms of the percentage of embryos that he was able to successfully genetically modify, but he does this work in the lab, he publishes the fact that none of these embryos are transferred, none of these embryos were healthy to start with, I'm just doing basic science. April of 2015, and there is an uproar. There's an uproar because you are manipulating human genetic reproductive material. And in December of that year, a meeting is held in Washington, hosted by the National Academy of Sciences, on this topic. I was a member of the planning committee for that meeting, and I can tell you, leading up to it, it's like, where is this meeting going? What's the lay of the land? And you're trying to figure out how people are going to position themselves on this science. And whenever policy happens around science, it's really challenging. Why? Because we have this ingrained idea that innovation is great, progress is great, right? And why would we want to stop that? And the interesting thing is, why is it that we believe innovation is inherently good? And how is it that we think we know what progress is? Anyhow, in the context of this meeting, over time, many of us are sort of struggling. And this is the end of the meeting, and I put that picture up because if you look in the middle, that's Jennifer Doudna. So, you know, you've got the top scientists there around the table trying to figure out what's going on. I didn't have white hair there, so I'm the person sitting right next to Jennifer. And this is like the moment where we're going to sort of release what we are announcing ought to be the policy perspective in this domain. It's available on the web. You can look at it in great detail, but I just wanted to share with you what I think is the most important thing. It says here it would be irresponsible to do this work unless you've met two conditions, safety and efficacy and broad societal consensus. Now, what I want to say up front, as somebody who does philosophy and ethics, this is the best ethics framework you could ever hope for. Why? Because it's really, really simple. It only has two things, safety and efficacy, broad societal consensus. If any of you look for ethics frameworks, they're typically lots and lots of details about what you'd need to do. So very, very simple, which I think is a very positive feature, attribute, and nobody knows what it means. Right? It's completely obtuse. Now, I want to say to you, I thought that was great. I actually thought that was a strength of the statement. So you could look at that and say, well, if nobody knows what it means, how can that be a strength? Because from my point of view, it meant, okay, we got to do some work here. We're actually setting out big, broad parameters, and we're saying, okay, so let's figure out what would safety and efficacy mean in this context. And what I want to say to you is safety and efficacy is actually not objective. And I think this makes it clear that it's not objective because somebody has to decide that it's safe enough, that it's effective enough, and it's never going to be 100%. So does it have to be 70% safe and effective? 98% safe and effective? You're going to have to do some moral work to decide at what point is it good enough to go, right? So this isn't saying we have the answer, but it's saying we know what the broad brushstrokes are. And for me, the commitment to broad societal consensus was really, really important. Why? Because to my way of thinking, you're talking about changing the human species. Well, this is not a decision that belongs to 10 head honchos in some business facility or in some government or in some lab, right? This is not a decision for politicians or scientists to make alone or even in concert with their buddies, right? This is something that belongs to all of us. Why? Because I've used the reference to the human genome as a metaphor for it's the one thing we all have in common. Now, please understand, it is a metaphor. We don't all, in one sense, have the same genome. But it was to say, look, we all have a right to actually weigh in on this. And that, for me right now, is a big part of the work that I'm doing going forward, is just trying to make those ideas available to people so that they can think about what their views are around this really important technology. This is the second scientist that you've already seen, Jean-Kyu Hey, and now we're fast-forwarding from 2015 to 2018, and on the eve of the second international summit on human genome editing, which is in Hong Kong, he announces to the world, pushed a little bit by some reporters here in the United States, that he has created two children that at that time they had been born, and he's claiming that they're in good health. Transparency. I am not on the planning committee for the second international summit in Hong Kong. Why the transparency? Because I'm now going to share with you the conclusions from that summit with which I disagree. So at the end of that summit, you see again a very similar array of people. Jennifer Doudna is still there amongst the many others, and there are some other people that overlap. So the planning committee for the 2018 meeting is about 50% from the 2015 and then 50% new. And in the abstract, that's great, right? You don't want the same people always at the same table, basically reiterating what they do. But notice how different this is. So the first one says you've got to meet two standards, safety and efficacy, broad societal consensus. Nobody in 2018 is going to say whatever those words mean that that standard has been met, and already you've done that which ought not to have been done without those two conditions being met. And yet what's interesting here is we've moved from doing work in a non-viable embryo in a lab, and then this sort of dramatic response to, oh, we have some babies now. And the response is, well, it could become acceptable in the future. Now's the time to define a rigorous, responsible, translational, meaning from the lab to the human, pathway towards such trials. So I think it's really fascinating historically to think about, you kind of have these like blocks when all you've done is work in the lab, and now that you actually have babies born, it's like, well, yeah, we got to do this slowly and carefully, but now's the time to go forward. One of the things that happens in that context is they now start getting much more complicated ethics frameworks, and so this is an example of what you would have for the elements of this rigorous, responsible pathway forward. These are not my words, this is the committee's words. And the only one I want to talk to you about off this list is the second one, compelling medical need. And why do I want to talk to you about that? Because the way our world works right now, we justify pretty much everything by compelling medical need, at least in the realm of science, right? Why are we doing this? It's going to fix cancer. Why are we doing this? Well, you know, baldness is a problem. Why are we doing this? There's lots of people with short stature. We want to bring them up in height. And if you think about them, in the abstract, these are all very good things, right? Because the examples I've given are things that are harmful. So why wouldn't we want to respond to different kinds of harms that people experience in the world? And so we describe this as we're doing this for a good reason to treat something. Think back to that first example I gave you of the designer baby, the mitochondrial replacement, the three-parent baby. They said we were going to do this, and I described it to you as we're going to do this to treat women that have defective genetic material in their mitochondria. It has been used once for that purpose. It has now been used around the world. I told you we think we have something like 200 babies to deal with infertility or to deal with age-related problems with eggs. It's never been used to treat a genetic disease since then. So what's a compelling medical need that requires us to develop CRISPR and to modify human embryos such that we will have genetically modified humans walking amongst us? Well, lots of examples are given, and I'm just going to highlight two of them. These are two genetic illnesses, Huntington's disease and cystic fibrosis. And it turns out that in the world, depending on how people couple and who their partners are, there are certain couples that no matter what they do, no matter what technology would be available to them, okay, and I mean that in terms of things like prenatal testing and maybe, you know, making choices about which embryos are healthy and worthy of being transferred, or perhaps they're pregnant and some people choose to access a termination of pregnancy, or they know they're at risk in advance so they choose to use donor gametes. There are many ways in which you could respond to couples who are perceived as being at risk of having children with a genetic illness. But here are two examples where no matter what science you do, you can't actually provide them with a healthy genetically related child. You could provide them with a healthy non-genetically related child through things socially like adoption or through things like science where you provided somebody else's genetic material, but you couldn't give them both a healthy genetically related child. And so that is supposed to be the compelling medical need. The compelling medical need is that there are couples in the world who, without this technology, could not have genetically related healthy children. Okay? Now, I want to say very clearly, I understand that having children is very important. I have two. But I actually don't support the claim that there's a right to have children. There isn't a right. It's a responsibility. Having children is ultimately a responsibility. If you spend all your time talking about your rights, you're not the right kind of person to be a parent, because that's not what having children is about. And in that context, I think the other thing that's really important to appreciate is this isn't necessarily going to work, and how many embryos are you going to destroy in the process? And at the end of the day, one of the things I talk about a lot in my work is opportunity costs. And when I talk about opportunity costs, I don't just mean money, I mean talent. People are working at this. What are they not doing that they could be doing? This slide is one of the busier slides. You don't need to read it except to get to the bottom line. And it's just to say that these are facts. This is not me inventing this. If it were used, and we just take the one example of cystic fibrosis, in the United States, you'd have one case every 15 years. You really think this is a compelling medical need? Let me tell you about all kinds of other things that are compelling medical needs. So that's the main argument for this technology. It's one that I don't accept. I'm happy to be challenged during the question period about what might be reasons to pursue this technology. After the 2018 summit, many of us who were on the original planning committee in 2015, but not in 2018, were very disappointed with that outcome, and we issued a call for a moratorium, which was published in Nature, saying, again, really, we have to do the work of broad societal consensus. And now the fact that we have these children doesn't mean it's like, okay, well, we're just going to go forward in this direction and think it's progress. We called for a moratorium. That has not been endorsed, but if you go back and read the paper, if they had endorsed the moratorium, it would be over now, right? There are scientists still working in this area. Jean Cuhey is out of jail. I'll tell you about that in a minute. And he has also gone back to doing this work and has announced that he too has gone back to doing heritable human genome editing. So I just presaged this particular slide. He was, in fact, ultimately held accountable, found guilty of practicing medicine without a license. That was the only way, given the laws that were on the books at the time in China, that he could be found guilty of having done something. So what he did is he practiced medicine without a license. He was in jail for 3 years. He's now out of jail, and he's doing this work again. He believes he will get a Nobel Prize, and he says that in all sincerity and honesty, and he points to who? Steptoe and Edwards, the very first slide that I showed you of the baby Louise Brown. At the time Louise Brown was born, there was this huge physical, this huge uproar. But Edwards got a Nobel Prize. He thought, and maybe he still thinks, one day the world will catch up to him, and he too will get a Nobel Prize. I just put up some images here to say that work is going on in the context of policy, etc. The third International Summit on Human Genome Editing took place in 2023 in March. And interestingly, I was invited back on the planning committee for this one. And so I actually like the conclusion here. One of the things that I think is really important is try to ensure that the final statement this time revisits, at least in ways that would still be acceptable to those who had authored the second report, to say that, look, we still have to resolve and continue to have discussion and debate about whether, not when, whether the technology should be used. And I was arguing, we haven't had that conversation yet about whether we should use it, and compelling medical need isn't sufficient. There has to be something more if you think it's worth doing this. And again, making the point that the societal discussion and policy debate has not been concluded. Now, you want to appreciate these are very difficult politically negotiated statements, right? So it doesn't say we need to have broad societal consensus again, right? Because some of the people would not be willing to sign on to that. But what's important is getting the commitment, the idea, social discussion, policy debate are important. I just put up here for you just so that you could see again very clearly what's happening. 2015, the statement's strong. It would be irresponsible. 2017, a report comes out from NASA and the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. Well, it should be permitted, but for compelling reasons and under strict oversight. And that's how by 2018, when you have the next meeting, you get it's time to define a rigorous, responsible pathway towards such trials. But 2023, from my point of view, we're pulling back. Public discussion and policy debates continue, and they are important for resolving whether this technology should be used. I think it's really important that we have those conversations, and I think it's really important that we have them around the world and in different contexts. Everything from, you know, a church group to a bar, right? This should be acceptable conversation the same way it's acceptable now to talk about things like mental health issues, which we didn't talk about, you know, 15, 20 years ago. It's now dinner conversation that you can talk about infertility, right? We need to have this be dinner conversation too. So I want to try to bring this all together now with the area that I work in, which is ethics, and I'm talking a little bit of some of the work that's in my book called Altered Inheritance. And in that book, one of the things I try to do is I try to say, look, people are really enthusiastic about this. Well, it's because it could do good things in the world, right? Like the only reason we talk about things and we talk about the potential harms is because we want to hold on to the good and we understand that there are some risks involved. So what I try to do in the book is I try to say, why would we want to embrace this technology? Well, clearly there are benefits to prospective parents, which I've kind of alluded to, if they want to have genetically healthy related children. There are benefits to the future children if they are born healthy or if they're born and would not otherwise have been born at all. There are potentially benefits to society and benefits to the gene pool. I'm not going to talk about all of those. I'm just going to highlight the one point about the benefits to the prospective parents. You've heard about this before, but I want to do justice to the claim, right? There's a reason people think this is good. I don't share that view, but I think it's important to understand it. So their view is it's important to be able to have genetically healthy and genetically related children. I worry about this because we've done so much progress as a society in understanding that there are many ways of having families and that they don't require blood relations, right? We have adoption, we have blended families, we have all kinds of ways of understanding family that we create out of meaningful ties, and I worry about the reification of the gene, that somehow that's the only thing that's family, genetic ties. So that's where I come from. Certainly, it will allow people to avoid the emotional, financial, and other burdens that are often associated with having to care for children that have a serious genetic disease. And I don't want to make light of that, right? So it's not just broad social consequences, like, for example, the financial burdens, but the emotional burdens. At the same time, there are many people that say those are things that we can and should embrace, and that many families do. For some people, it will be seen as a very positive thing that you'll be able to provide them, your children, with enhancements. So this will not just be to avoid certain kinds of genetic illnesses, but to provide them with certain opportunities. And I want to be really clear about this. We do this all the time. And we actually, as a society, believe that enhancements are good, right? Like, why are you here at a university, right? Right? You believe there's something here that you can learn, and that's good, and you're helping to enhance your brain. Why do parents send their kids to piano lessons? Because they think it's good and it will enhance their opportunities. The same thing can be said about sport. So as a society, we're already deeply committed to enhancement. This is an enhancement, right? So we believe in enhancements. And so many people are saying, like, this is just a different means. We've already embraced the goal. Why is this means problematic? And so the idea is that as a parent, it would be responsible of me to help make sure that my child has opportunities, and I can do that by improving their, you know, vision or their acuity or their, you know, muscle mass or whatever it is I think might be good for my children. But as I said, we're trying to weigh that up against certain kinds of harms. And these are the harms that I try to describe in the book. And I'd like to believe that people will pay attention to the first harm that I mentioned, which is harms to women. And that's because nobody talks about the harms to women with this. Why? Because we talk about the tissue, we talk about the gametes, we talk about the children that might be born. But this is experimentation on women, right? Like, how do you get these babies? You have to put them into women. And yes, maybe one day we'll have an ex utero ectogenesis world, but right now, to do this, you have to put them into women. And the other thing is you actually have to get sperm and egg to do this. And not that difficult to get the sperm from the men. It's a really big deal to get eggs from women, right? It's very onerous physically, emotionally, etc. So one of the things I talk about here are the harms to women. And I want people to pay attention that with those harms, there's a certain kind of exploitation that's happening in pursuit of a goal or objective that may not be the goal or objective of the woman. And I think we ought to pay attention to that. And the thing that I also try to make people realize is it's not just the harm of the actual transfer of this genetically modified material, but you have to appreciate that things might go wrong, and if you were to pursue this, they certainly will go wrong. It's not going to be 100% safe. And so when it goes wrong, are you going to compel the woman to have a termination of pregnancy? Because, like, hey, I'm a big important scientist. I don't want this as my legacy. No, we got to get rid of this. Is that what you're going to ask the woman to do? If she says no and wants to have this child, who's going to care for this child? Where's that burden going to fall? And so one of the things that became very important to me in this is to say, eggs and embryos are not just in a lab on a shelf, and we can't just talk about them as if they're tissue. We need to pay attention to the women that are involved in this project. And because so much emphasis has been on the benefits to prospective parents, I wanted to really also say that there are some potential harms to the prospective parents. And really, it's inviting people to appreciate it may not work. It may be a disaster. Right? So what are the scenarios in which you don't just have this ideal child that you think you're going to have? And then the other thing, which is really important that I wanted to emphasize, is when we embrace the technology, we change the world we live in. We just do. Right? The world we all live in right now with our dependence on cell phones is not the world I grew up in, and we're not going backwards. Right? But that whole way of navigating our space has radically changed. And if you bring this in, there will be social pressure to use it, and we will just become a very different kind of world. Now, that doesn't mean it's good, bad, or indifferent, but it means we sure ought to think about it, talk about it, and worry about it. I want to end by emphasizing what I think is most important in this space, and that's building consensus. And it really is sort of the work that I do, and it's really what undergirds my efforts here. One day, you'll recognize this, Alice came to a fork in the road, and she saw a Cheshire cat in a tree. Which road do I take? Right or left, right? Where do you want to go, says the cat. I don't know, Alice answers. Well, then it doesn't really matter. And so my whole talk today is to say to you, yeah, well, it does matter, right? And you are always at a fork in the road when it comes to the embrace of any kind of technology. And if you haven't spent time thinking about where you want to go, in this case, meaning what kind of world you want to live in ultimately, more specifically, what constraints, if any, do we put on what otherwise is thought of as a personal choice, right? Like when I reproduce, it's a personal choice. You don't get to weigh in on that. Right? So how do we change that mindset that says maybe it's not a personal choice, maybe it does matter? I've been doing a lot of writing around consensus, and I just put this up there to say, look at that bottom line. This is what consensus is about. It's about inclusivity, it's about responsibility, it's about self-discipline in terms of how you participate in that. It's about respect for others, it's about cooperation, struggle. And the struggle part is not everybody's going to agree as you go on this project of building consensus. And the benevolence is really at the end about kindness, right? Not everybody gets what they want when you try to work towards consensus. These are images here. I'm not going to speak to the slide. It's really meant as a teaser. This is a talk I gave in Berlin, and I gave it on the day that Donald Trump was first elected. So I remember where I was when Donald Trump was elected. And the reason I mention that is because I was in Berlin celebrating the taking down of the Berlin Wall. And so the question I'd been asked to answer is, what would it mean to take down this wall around the science of genome editing? And I focused my whole talk on consensus building. And I made the point that you've already heard, this is not a decision to be made in the lab. This is not a decision to be made in the boardroom. It is a decision to be made in kitchens, because that's where we all congregate, right? And think about the conversations you have in your kitchen. They are very different than the conversations you might have elsewhere. The talk's available online. If you have if I've piqued your interest at all, please go and have a look. It's relatively easy to find. What you need to understand about consensus at the end of the day is it doesn't mean we all agree. What it means is we've all had a chance to make sure that our ideas were on the table. And that's all I'm arguing for all of you, that you have a chance to have your ideas on the table. I'm going to skip this slide in the interest of time, because I really want to make sure that I've left you a good 15, 20 minutes to challenge anything that I've said or to amplify anything that I've said. But I do want to just put up for you what happens to this notion of consensus from that 2015, when we start having public debate and conversation, to where we are today. 2015, I'm at the table, I'm arguing broad societal consensus. And I acknowledge nobody knows what that means. I've spent a lot of time since then arguing for what it means, right? And making sure that I'm not arguing for majority rule, I'm not arguing for 100% agreement, I'm arguing for consensus, which means everybody gets to be at the table, and everybody has to believe that their ideas have at least been listened to. This is the guidelines from the International Stem Cell Research, and they change the wording slightly, and they start talking about broad international consensus. I want to say to you, I think it's a subtle change, but it's an important change. Societal refers to all of us, refers to society. International, to me, refers to international organizations. So you're moving it up a level in terms of who gets to participate and decide. 2018, we're talking about broad and inclusive, but notice we've now moved to societal debate. And this is what comes out of the Nuffield Council in 2018. And, you know, I know the folks there, and I call up Pete, and I say, Pete, how do you know when the debate's over? Right? I mean, like, why did you pick the word debate, right? I know when my debate or discussion's over because we've argued for consensus. We've got to figure out what consensus means, but we know when the conversation's over. You're arguing for broad and inclusive societal debate. For how long? To what end? And look what happens by 2018. And this is coming out of the National Academy of Sciences here. And it's moved from broad societal to broad scientific. Think of the power of words. I went for a walk this morning, and in the sidewalk, not far from where I was staying, there's four lines about the importance of words and not just casting them about. And if you haven't seen it, go for a search and find those words. I took a picture because I'm going to use it in a talk that I'm going to give again. I mean, really, it's so meaningful to me because you don't realize the words have changed. But if you only pay attention on contemporary stuff, you think you're like up to date, but you've forgotten the trajectory and you may end up have lost some of the richness. We're back to broad societal consensus. That's the article I showed you that some of us who were on the first planning committee came back and penned in our call for a moratorium. We're saying, no, we really did mean broad societal consensus. Now we're moving on, international scientific consensus, clear scientific consensus, consensus on ethics, you know, broad societal consensus. What's that? Guess what? That's the WHO. I'm on the committee again. So one of the things that I'm saying, like, I'm sort of saying this to you sort of somewhat in jest, but I want to say to you, you know what? You should take away as another take-home message. It matters who's on which committee and how they're able to express things. And that matters both positively and negatively, right? Because I will say to you, you ought to be worried if I'm at the table all the time, right? Not because I think my ideas are great, but like if you didn't like my ideas, it's a problem that I'm at the table all the time, right? And I want to say that to you because whenever you see what looks to you like an emerging consensus on anything, any topic, go back and see, is it five different organizations, but the same 10 people behind the doors of the five different organizations? Because that's a problem, right? And I'm saying this openly because it can be leveled at me, and I have to be able to answer that. But I want you to pay attention to words, how they shift, but they have different meanings. It's not all the same thing. I'm going to go down to my grave arguing for broad societal consensus. I think it's important. I offer that to you because if you care about it, you have to fight for it. I mean, I can't give it to you. I can't say, oh yeah, you're going to have it, right? Like, you have to believe it's important and you have to do the work that's required. So I'm going to end with what? The future? This is not science fiction. I really believe it's not science fiction. The last or the next step, and we are doing this, okay? We're not doing it very loudly, we're not doing it very publicly, but it is happening. We're doing work in synthetic biology, and in that context, we're doing two kinds of things, and I'm not going to go into the details because I don't need to get into the science here, but we will have the ability to make humans without using gametes, without using eggs and sperm as the starting point. It may not happen in my lifetime, but I believe there will come a time where if I want to have any of your babies, male or female, I'll just take you out for a cup of coffee, maybe a glass of wine, and when you leave, I will make sure I take that container with me. And I will try to get somebody to extract some DNA, and I'll say, make me a sperm, please. And they will be able to do it. And I want to emphasize, this is not science fiction. We have proof of principle. The work has been done in mice using tail cells, okay? And so what they're able to do is take a tail cell, turn it into sperm, take a tail cell, turn it into an egg, put the egg and the sperm together, and get pups. And they have had those pups reproduce, and they are able to reproduce. That's the world you will be living in. If you get to a fork in the road and you don't know where you want to go, and you just kind of keep wandering. Or it could be the world you live in because you got to a fork in the road and you decided that's where we want to go. I just want you to live in the world where you made the decision. You didn't just wake up one morning and you're in a world and it wasn't the world you were trying to create. That's why I'm encouraging you to think about it or debate about it. This is another context in which you would probably also pursue some options in synthetic biology, but instead of starting with somatic cells, you'd be starting with stem cells. And again, I don't need to go into the science of it right now. What I want you to appreciate is the ability to make embryos without starting with fertilization. And who will this help? It will help a number of people, and so people will say there's a compelling medical need. It will help, for example, women who don't have eggs, right? If you're a woman right now and for any number of reasons you don't have eggs, you'll be able to say, take my skin cells, make me some eggs, and I too can have a genetically related child. If you're a same-sex couple, right now, one of you might contribute genetic material and the other person would become an adoptive parent. Or in the context of two women, might become the surrogate who would carry the pregnancy and the other partner would contribute the genetic material. But now you could say to your partner, which one of you wants to make which gamete? And so you could have same-sex couples both make a genetic contribution. And if you believe that genetic parenting is what's most important, that would be seen as progress. You have the problem of eggs in storage, and we are basically building huge biobanks of frozen eggs. You wouldn't have to have that problem. You just make them whenever you need them. And of course, we're going to get to ectogenesis at some point, and so then that would just be completing the whole trajectory outside of the body. Will we get there? It'll depend on what? It'll depend on what we ultimately end up believing is the moral status of the human embryo. If we really believe it's protectable human life, it becomes an argument for synthetic biology, right? Or are you going to now say that synthetic embryos, too, are protectable human life? These are choices we have to make. The thing that's important is there's no doubt whether it's synthetic or naturally created that it is human. From a moral point of view, the question is it a person? My last slide. You've seen it before. One day, Alice comes to a fork in the road. Alice is a metaphor for all of you. When you get to that fork in the road, if you're asking for help and direction, do you know where you want to go? Do you have any idea of the world you're trying to build? That's the question my book invites you to answer. What kind of world do you want to live in? And it's ultimately up to you. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Françoise, for being here today. An excellent talk. We're going to open up to Q&A in just a second. Of course, we just have to mention a couple of things. Next week, we will enjoy Alex Weber, Unstoppable Leadership. Alex is an international keynote speaker, award-winning host for NBC, U.S. Lacrosse Coach of the Year, and a competitor on America Ninja Warrior. He, using humor and storytelling, Alex connects with audiences because of genuine openness about challenges, self-doubt, uncertainty that we all face and how we can overcome it. As to Convo Lunch, we've had a couple cancellations. So if you'd like to join us for luncheon, we do have a few seats at the table. Please see me afterwards. On that note, we're going to open up to Q&A. And we invite our friends on Zoom as well to participate. They will be forwarded to my phone, but we already have one phone-in question, which I'm going to lead with, and we'll get to you. And the question is, could Dr. Bayless speak a little about the ethics around selecting against mutations with a high likelihood of developing cancer, for example, BRCA, that are not definitively deadly? Now that we have the choice, what side of history will we be on if we choose not to do this for our children?
So, I mean, that's an excellent question because it actually allows me to move in a couple of directions. One of the things I think is really important to appreciate is that we can use this technology to select against and also to select for, right? And so that in and of itself is an interesting kind of phenomenon. I think when we identify something that we think is harmful, painful, life-shortening, or at least impacting quality of life, we have this idea that we should get rid of that. Certainly, I think, you know, if I or, you know, members of my family were at risk for a specific genetic disease and I thought, well, here's an easy and obvious solution, there would be a certain kind of enthusiasm for that. I can sort of certainly appreciate that. And I don't know how I would respond were that on offer. What I do know is what I would come back to is sort of a big picture thing. And it is something I worry about. And it all comes back to what kind of world are we building? And I worry about that sometimes in the context of, is it just about getting rid of everything that we think is painful? Do we actually think that we don't learn anything from challenges? And some of those challenges will be health challenges, some of them will be other kinds of things. So I'm not advocating for anybody turning away from opportunities to remove illness, and especially illness that's within a family. But I do also always want us to think about what path are you getting on such that you try to eliminate everything. And I say that for just to tie it into another technology, just because I would like people to appreciate that a lot of what I say can apply to different technologies. I spent a lot of time at one point working with neuroscientists who thought that they had ways of actually erasing horrible memories. And doesn't that sound like a wonderful thing? Like if you have really truly horrific memories from trauma, from rape, from other things that, you know, participation in war, wouldn't it be a great thing to do that? And one of the things I invited people to think about is, like, look, I can't imagine that kind of pain and living with it on a daily basis. And so in the abstract, that sounds like a really good idea. But because my work is always about thinking, well, what's the other side of the coin? It's like, what would it mean to live in a world where you don't understand who I am because there's no opportunity for me to remember the pain and to share that with you and for you to show me empathy and understanding and caring? What does that world look like? I think that we are marked by the things that we deal with and continue to deal with as challenges, and sometimes we will overcome them and sometimes we won't. But what happens when you take away the opportunity for overcoming challenges? So I hope that was a complicated answer, because I mean for it to be understood as it's easy to say that would be great, let's just like take it out of the human species. But sometimes we don't know what we're getting rid of.
Hi, thank you for coming today. That was a fantastic talk. I think it's an admirable goal to try to build societal consensus about new technologies like this, but it seems to me rather unrealistic thinking about how science progresses, like a lot of big steps in the past 100 years, creating nuclear bombs, yeah, making AI, making the internet. I'm curious if you see any realistic methods towards bringing about public debate and societal consensus. I mean, yeah, I hardly even knew that this technology existed before coming here today. I think most people in the world don't know about this and certainly don't think about this. So how do you see this as becoming a kitchen topic?
So I want to grant you your first comment, because you're absolutely right. And there are ways in which what I'm offering is very Pollyannish, right? Like, really, come on. Consensus, give it a break, you know? And I only have one response, and, you know, it's the one I repeat all the time. I am prepared to stand before you here today and say, you know what? I could be wrong. I'm probably wrong. But you know what? We'll be all better off for having tried. So if we don't reach consensus, maybe all the other things we will have done along the way trying to get there will make for a better world, because we'll have heard people who have very radically different ideas than we do. We'll have tried to engage with them respectfully. We'll have tried to do that in a way that's benevolent and attentive to the sorrows that they experience. So that when I stand here and I say things like, I don't think this is medically compelling, I don't know that there isn't somebody in the audience that's thinking like, well, really? Sorry. Like, that's not how I see the world. And, you know, that's why I really like the opportunity to have a conversation afterwards, because I want people to be able to challenge me and I want to better understand where people are situated. So the first part is to say, yeah, it may not be achievable, but we will be better off for having tried. I really genuinely do believe that. How do we go about it? I think that what we need to do is to be much more inclusive. So that's why the first thing about inclusivity is so important. If we can just show respect for people who have different life experience and different worldviews, and we are starting to do that. There are ways in which we've made progress. I mean, think about some of the conversations you may have heard or read about with respect to different worldviews amongst indigenous populations. If you actually are open to that, you can actually learn. I can't tell you the number of things I have learned from my Indigenous colleagues who have a different starting point in terms of how they understand their relationship to nature and to the earth. And we can learn from them, right? But you can't learn if every time you walk into the room, you're the smartest person in the room, right? And that's one of the problems we have right now, you know, especially those of us who have the privilege of being in institutions of higher learning, right? It is really a privilege to be here, but how often do we listen as opposed to pontificate? And that's one of the things I worry about when I, you know, give the kinds of talks I give, which is why I try to spend time saying, I could be wrong, there are other people with different perspectives, I want to make sure you understand mine, but that doesn't mean that I can't learn. And so I think what I'm asking for is a different kind of openness and tolerance, and it is in short supply. But if we don't turn our heads to that as an important challenge, how are we going to get any better at it? So it's about trying. Yeah.
Hi. This one. Thank you for coming. I was in a genetics course last term, actually, where we had a debate about this very thing. And one of the arguments that was made against this germline editing was that, sort of to your point in your first response, that like if we edit out anything that we deem suboptimal, is that also part of erasing the thing that gives humanity its vibrancy? Like, is that also, are some of these, albeit painful, diseases, are these part of our human heritage? And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
So I certainly do worry about the homogenization or the potential homogenization, which is why I put up those images of those sort of magazine covers showing like what they think the perfect baby would look like. And I do think that there is something very valuable in diversity, both culturally, socially, genetically, in terms of having that. I also think that one of the things that becomes really important is to appreciate what we do learn by hardships. And I think in that context, you know, there just are tangible experiences that people share. You know, so for example, I have a colleague who has written a couple of books, one of them called Choosing Down Syndrome, right? He has a child with Down syndrome. He was a very strong advocate of the woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. He is still a very strong advocate of that. In the context of his personal life, he was supportive of his wife, and his wife said, no, we are having this child. And he has written about what it means to choose that. And part of what he talks about is there's no information available to a couple to understand all of the benefits that come with having a child with Down syndrome. So he has made it his life work to say, it's not a one-sided story. Yes, there are potential harms and there are potential benefits. How did we end up in a discourse where we can't see both sides of that? You know, I have... a scenario where I have been tested for sickle cell disease, and so I and my family are at risk. We're not, thanks to testing, but this is technology that has just been approved for use in somatic genome editing to treat people with sickle cell disease. And the first patients have been treated in clinical trials, and it's moving out of clinical trials into that. And that is a very painful disease, and that is something that I think and hope people will embrace. The interesting question, and it's one that I don't have an answer for, is do you do heritable human genome editing where you will have an impact on all of your progeny, or do you do somatic genome editing where you're responding to a person who's suffering? And ultimately, that's the hard part here, because some people will say, one and done. Like, what are you doing? Generation after generation after generation, you're going to treat this? Let's just eradicate it. But there is a difference in responding to a person who's suffering and bringing the resources to care for that person versus creating a being who didn't exist and would not exist but for our intervention. So I hope that answers a little bit of what you were talking about in the class there.
Hi, thank you so much for such an amazing talk. I have two questions. The first is, in terms of this consensus building, how do you see kind of the conversations that are happening in kitchens and living rooms going on and influencing policy, considering that we have such a problem these days in terms of policymakers, both nationally and internationally, not necessarily listening to public opinion? And my second question is, kind of on a broad-based societal scale, how do you see these technologies, if they were to be implemented and embraced, affecting kind of equity and societal distribution, given that they would probably mostly be available to those in first world countries or with the economic resources to use them?
So that certainly is a very important theme that I explore in the book, and there's no way that this technology will ever be distributed equitably. There's no world that I can imagine in which that happens. And so one of the things I talk about with respect to the technology in the context of heritable human genome editing, I literally talk about this as an opportunity for people to entrench their privilege in their DNA. So why? Because it will be the people with resources, whether they are intellectual resources, financial resources, physical resources, who would avail themselves of this technology and who would drag it, if you will, in a very specific kind of direction. And, you know, getting back to the other, you know, comment about broad societal consensus, I think, you know, part of what you're looking at, or part of what I'm looking at, is trying to build a world in which we can agree on the building blocks. We may never agree on, you know, what the link is, the causal link between being committed to these values and embracing or not embracing this particular technology, and that's great, we continue to have that. Where do I see progress being made? So I shared with you that I was on the WHO committee that looked, and for those of you who don't know, that's the World Health Organization committee that looked at governance of heritable human genome editing. And when you work on one of those committees, you get a remit. You get told, here, this is your job. You've got like 18 months, 2 years to work on it. We expect a report. Here's the question, or here's the problem you're supposed to address. And one of the things that's interesting is, you know, we worked on that committee, and then at the end, when we finished our report, I actually argued, we actually need to say back to the Director General, Tedros, something that's beyond our remit. In other words, something we were not asked to do. And one of the things that we did as a committee that we were not asked to do was I said, you know, it's kind of a problem for you as the World Health Organization to say to a committee like us, here's a problem, heritable human genome editing, tell us, you know, what our values should be and how we should sort this out. And it's like, you're WHO, like, don't you have your own values? Like, shouldn't you have gone to the committee and say, these are our core values, this is what WHO stands for, you take this now and figure out how we can be true to our values with this technology. And the Director General endorsed all of the recommendation, and that is actually a formal recommendation. The very next committee that WHO had was actually on governance in the life sciences, and what you're looking at there are things like pathogens of pandemic potential. And because of the work that I'd done with genome editing, I ended up working on the WHO committee on life sciences and the governance of that, which is connects. But what dragged me over is not my understanding of the science. What dragged me over into that space of work was my understanding of the values and principles and bringing it to a different group of scientists. And what happens is they don't just accept it holus bolus and carry it over. They massage it and they change it in light of what they understand to be their area of science. So that's where I'm hoping for progress, is that we can get some agreement on the fundamental values and principles, and hopefully one of them is equity. Thanks.
Very good. On that note, we must conclude. If you didn't get a chance to get your question, join us for lunch. Otherwise, thank you, Professor Bayless, for being here. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for coming, really.